This is WUOT. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. The University of Tennessee's Siddiqui Lecture in Islamic Studies was launched in 2014 to bring top scholars in the field of Islamic studies to UT Knoxville and to develop a greater understanding of Islam in East Tennessee. The 2019 Siddiqui Lecturer is Omid Safi, a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Duke University, specializing in Persian mystical literature, the interaction of religion and politics, contemporary issues of Islamic reform, and progressive interpretations of Islam. Dr. Safi's lecture is entitled A Love Supreme, Rumi's Path of Islamic Spirituality, and we spoke to him about the famous Muslim love poet.
Rumi, the most important Muslim love poet, who is having a heck of a afterlife career in America. The last 30 years or so, he's become the best-selling poet in America as well. So kind of here to talk about how this 13th century Persian-speaking, God-loving Muslim ends up also being adopted by so many people in this country as one of the main sources of their own spiritual life here.
So when you talk about Rumi being a love poet, Tell me what you mean by that. I get the feeling that you don't mean romantic love. You mean spiritual relationship with God.
Yes, and all the above. I think, you know, one of the interesting crises that we see in so many of our lives is that people describe their existence as kind of being loveless or having a love deficit. And sometimes what they mean is a deficit of romantic love, that either they don't have a partner or that the relationship that they're in maybe is not all that they had hoped it would be. And when you study the life of these mystics, one of the things that they talk about is that, you know, love is a whole rainbow. And what we tend to think of as romantic love, physical love, even sexual love, all of these, that's just one shade of it, and that is a much broader spectrum. So one of the first questions they always ask you is, do you love your mama? Do you love your daddy? Do you love your sibling? Do you love your child? Do you love a puppy? Do you love rainbows? Do you love snow? We went for a beautiful hike yesterday in the Smokies National Park. Do you love trees? Do you love the sound of a gushing river? And if you do, then you know love. You know something about love. So they're kind of trying to expand that sense of love. Do you love a friend? Do you love a neighbor? And I think the one that we would do really well to reflect on these days, do you love a stranger? And then to think of all these loves, the love of humanity, the love of nature, the love of God, as in fact all emanating from one source. They're all linked together.
Do you think that Rumi is seeing such a resurgence now because of that deficit?
I do. I think a lot of people have found that many of the traditional forms and institutions of religiosity aren't really meeting their needs. So they're looking for something more personal, something more immediate, unmediated, something where you're not going through necessarily a church or a mosque or a temple or a priest or a rabbi or an imam, but you're having your own direct personal encounter face-to-face, heart-to-heart with God. And, you know, this is a poet who for more than 700 years has had some of these most extraordinary teachings and stories and poems about how to achieve that. So I think there's a lot of folks now in this country who are also searching, and they're seeking, but seeking it in different places, without necessarily always wanting to change their religious label. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to go deeper in terms of who they are. And there's an openness, there's a thirst that sometimes you experience. And one of the things that Rumi tells you is that that thirst itself is a gift, that you don't sometimes realize that you're standing knee-deep in divine waters until your lips become parched.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
700 years.
Yeah.
Long time.
Long
for
time.
Someone to be cherished. Has he always been so popular in the Middle East?
In not just the Middle East, but actually everywhere from India to Iran to Central Asia to Afghanistan to Turkey, even on to Southeast Europe. So in Iran, his book of poetry, the Masnavi, achieved the rare distinction of being called the Quran in Persian. It's an honorific, but it gives you some sense of the extraordinary prestige that that his poetry has. And his love poetry is taught to children starting in second grade. So as a kid myself who grew up in Iran, imagine being taught in second grade poetry from the 1200s. And what I tell people is that, you know, this would be akin not to teaching our second graders Shakespeare, but actually Chaucer, to teach them that, you know, something from the 1200s still holds a key for what it means to be human, to live and to love and to yearn and to find. In India, his poetry is a part of Qawwali music and these ecstatic forms of sacred dance and song. In Turkey, if people have ever heard of the dervishes, the whirling dervishes, the whirling dervishes are one particular mystical community that traces itself back to Rumi. And the whirling was not really a dance. It was a kind of disciplining of the body. Can you learn to be present inside yourself? Can you spot your breath? Can you think of your breath as a prayer itself? And so, you know, in all these different cultures, from India to Iran, to Central Asia, to Turkey, in a place that we don't tend to think of necessarily very much, the former Yugoslavia, in Bosnia, they had entire universities that were devoted to studying Rumi's poetry in the original. So, you know, he's had a vast influence over all these different regions. And now, 700 years after, in Europe and North America, you've got millions of people who are again discovering him, slightly adapted to our own taste over here. But there is something beautiful about seeing so many people who are getting married, and on the back of their wedding invitation, you've got a poem from Rumi. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere. They are in each other all along. Mm. And they find in that an indication of their own heart's yearning.
Please read us.
Oh, something. Sure. So these are, you know, some of the kinds of poems that meant a lot to Rumi. And you'll see how evocative they are, and to a certain extent, how they speak to people of different traditions. So this one is called Wherever You Are. He says, wherever you are, be right there, fully present. Another friend of mine has translated that as, wherever you are, be the soul of that place.
Oh, that's nice.
That's good, too.
Yeah,
but you know, this sense that so much of the times we spend our lives scattered between worrying about something that happened in the past that caused us pain, or hopeful even about something in the future, and we're everywhere except for here. And even when it comes to the realm of religion, for so many people, it's, you know, what do I have to believe and what do I have to do in order to get into heaven or in order to avoid hell? And for Rumi, it's about the here and the now. Mm-hmm. It's if there is a heavenly state, you can live your life as if you're already in that state. So this is another one. And this kind of gets back to that way that he talks about a love that you could read it as romantic, or it could be about a friendship, or it could be about being with somebody who inspires you, or it could be being with God, whom Rumi called the friend. So he says this, "Paradise will be exalted," they say. "Fine wine, a beautiful beloved," they say. "Here and now we are intoxicated, cuddling with my beloved. So it is now as it shall be then."
Really the focus on the allusions to what other people think, how easy it is to be focused on something that's not up to you.
That's right. To detach yourself from all the kind of projections that people have about you. That's a liberating existence. And instead, to polish the mirror of your heart, as he says. One teaching that Rumi's followers have is, think about when you wake up in the morning and you first go to the bathroom to brush your teeth and you get the first glimpse of yourself. What's the response that so many of us have?
And,
right? I think if we're being polite and using radio appropriate vocabulary, we would say, "You look like death warmed over," right? And one of the things that Rumi wants you to actually do, and this is an actual teaching that his order teaches, is in the morning when you go in front of a mirror, could you look at yourself and say, "You are a child of God, and in you I see the light of God shining." And as you go through your daily encounters with human beings, with each person that you come across, to practice that notion of presence, where your commitment is to honor that presence of God in every person, in every plant, in every animal that you come across, and you yourself are not exempt from that. You're not any better than anybody, but nor are you any less than anybody else. Mm. I've got a little bottle of water here to drink. Beautiful teachings that you see that when he would go to drink some water, he would pick up the bottle and kiss it before he would drink it. And people would say, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, this too has a soul. And I want to greet the soul of this bottle before I would drink from it."
What can you tell us about his life? This person who spent so much of his life being touched by the world around him, who was he?
In today's language, we would call him a refugee. He was born in what is today Central Asia, near the border of Afghanistan. And at that time, in the 13th century, the Mongols were coming, which were the most destructive force in the world. So his family had to flee. And he traveled through what is today Iran and ended up in Turkey. He lived there for the rest of his life. It was a very cosmopolitan place with Greeks and Arabs and Jews and Armenians and Persians all living side by side, mostly in peace. He was an academic. He was a law professor, of all things. And then when he's in his late 30s, he meets this extraordinary teacher who helps take him from book knowledge to heart knowledge. He teaches him that God and love are not words on a page, but a fire that has to burn in your heart. And he makes it real for him. And that's, I think, what takes him from being just another extraordinary scholar to be in this love poet that the world wants to remember.
Did you come to Rumi through being taught his poetry as a child?
My parents recited it to me all of my childhood. I remember being 14 and 15 and enamored of his love poetry. I spent a year in high school here in Knoxville, And every time I would get my heart broken and fall in love with some pretty Tennessee girl, or later on, a pretty Florida girl, I would find some Rumi poem that suited my mood. And as I got older, I was able to appreciate a little bit fuller context of the teachings that he had, and how this is a love that is simultaneously human and divine. And in fact, for Rumi, one of the main teachings is that you have to be able to hold God and humanity in one breath together. And what you say about God has to radically transform what you say about humanity. That if you claim to love God, you have to begin by loving humanity. And not just romantically, but really every person that you come across.
It sounds like that is how he has managed to be so precious to so many different people of all different religions. I mean, he's clearly very important in the Persian world.
Yeah.
He's important in the Muslim world.
That's right.
And now he's important all over the world where there are mixes of religions, to Christians, to Buddhists, to all of these people.
I think that's right. And it's one of the things that makes him such an inspiring figure. And, you know, one of the reasons that I'm drawn to mystical teachers of different traditions is that in some ways, the deeper they go in their own being and the deeper they go in their own tradition, the more what they have to say becomes relevant and applicable to people of all faiths. So, you know, as I adore the teachings of Rumi, and I'm happy to talk about him, tomorrow, actually on Wednesday, I'm going to New York to give a talk on Dr. King. And Dr. King is unabashedly a Christian spiritual figure. And that weekend, I'm going to do a weekend retreat that will include something on Rabbi Heschel, who is unabashedly a Jewish mystic. And you don't want all of these people to become some kind of a mystic soup, right? That's what gives each of them a flavor, is the fact that Rumi is a Muslim mystic and Dr. King is a Christian seeker and Heschel is a Jewish mystic. But each one of them speaks in a way that spills over from their own cup. And the fountain of their love is so rich and so overflowing that if you're anywhere near them, you can't help but drink from it.
Yeah. I like the way you put it, though, to go deeper into yourself, you end up speaking to everyone.
That's right. And, you know, one of the ways that Rumi talks about it is that in that book of his, the Masnavi, which was called the Quran in Persian, the very first line of it, he says, you have to find out what the root of the root of the root of yourself is. It's a tree metaphor. And, you know, we got so many beautiful old trees around here, and you got to think about what is it that the roots of a tree do? They ground you. And when the storm of life comes, are you going to get knocked over? Or are you rooted in something that's going to keep you standing? And the roots also is where you draw your nutrients from. And so he's telling you, if you're going to, don't just be religious. Don't be a dry religious. Be moist. Be fruitful. Draw that kind of sustenance so that you can give this ripe, succulent, juicy fruit to others. So the thing that he has no patience for is a kind of holier-than-thou self-righteousness that's kind of dry and withered. He says, no, that's not rooted. That's a dry tree that's going to fall over when the good first stiff wind of life, the first storm of life hits you.
As someone then who travels, speaks to people about mysticism and religion and spirituality, do you personally feel that there is a trend toward this juicier spirituality than there has been in the past?
There is. And, you know, I think Rumi sometimes uses this this metaphor that the sweeter the honey, the more flies it attracts. And I think one of the things that we got to be just a little watchful for is that America is many, many things. It's a beautiful country filled with forests and rivers and people of all backgrounds who've come here with their own hopes and dreams and vulnerabilities. And it's also the driving force of the market. And anything that's beautiful can be commodified and marketized and commercialized. So on one hand, you got millions and millions of people who are seeking, spiritually seeking for something that's beautiful and rooted and grounded and sweet and life-affirming and love-affirming. And there's also plenty of folks out there who are trying to figure out how to make money off of that. And I think that's something that I always urge people to be on guard about is, you know, Rumi has this beautiful metaphor that he says, how do you know when the fruit of a tree is really ripe? He says, and the tree that has the sweetest fruit, its branches are hanging down close to the earth to the point that it's almost touching the ground. So he says that the sweeter the fruit on a branch, the lower they're hanging, the more humble they are. So I think, you know, the people who really have something to offer, there has to be an element of service involved. If you love the people, you serve the people. If you love the folk, you be with the folk. And someone who's just, you know, standing up like a cypress tree that doesn't have anything to offer, but is just charging you for the privilege of being near them, that's, you want to be a little suspicious of that. And, you know, we don't have to look far and wide to find all the ways in which authority is being abused in this country right now. And that's just as true in the religious realm. Mm. And there's no tradition that's exempt from that. Christian, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, atheist, all of us have institutions where there has been financial abuse, sexual abuse, and other. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that Rumi always talks about the people who are teaching. They have to always be doing the work on themselves so that their eyes look at you with a pure glance, that their touch is a touch which never grabs but only brings comfort, that their mouth only speaks healing words, not biting words.
Thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.